Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Inquiry concerning the Iraq conflict. It is called CHILCOT, C-H-I-L-C-O-T. And it's a report on the Blair government and the case for an American Nuremberg trial for the Bush administration. My guest is Professor Rebecca Gordon. She is in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's a professor of political philosophy and the theories of justice at the University of San Francisco, where she is also associated with the school's Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good. And through much of Rebecca's career, she has worked in national and international peace and justice movements, including the anti-apartheid movement in U.S. and South Africa, and liberation struggles among the poor in Central America, and much of the 1984 living in the war zones in Nicaragua, and anti-war efforts opposing U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. She is the founder of the Californians for Justice, a statewide organization working on behalf of marginalized social, racial, and ethnic groups. She holds degrees from Reed College and a doctorate in ethics and social theory from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And she's published several books dealing with the conflicts in Central America, as well as welfare reform and the ethical issues concerning torture during the post-9/11 period. Her most recent book is American Nuremberg, The Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. And her website is mainstreamingtorture.org. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure. I'm delighted.
I'd like to begin with the British inquiry into the invasion of Iraq. It's also called CHILCOT, which was launched by Tony Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, and was carried out for 6 to 7 years to determine the legitimacy of Blair and his administration's siding with the Bush White House and whether or not this was reckless or perhaps even a criminal act. We do know from one email that Tony Blair, one day after the attack on the World Trade Center on September 12th, encouraged Bush to strongly consider regime change in Afghanistan immediately. He said, quote, "Act now and explain and justify later," end quote. And there are other peculiarities to the Bush-Blair relationship that indicates the British Prime Minister was very much on the same wavelength as the neocons in the Pentagon. So I'd appreciate you outlining this Iraq inquiry because it's quite damning of the British government during Blair's tenure at its helm. And what were its primary findings? What were the illegal issues, either against the U.S., U.K.'s own statutes for invading a foreign nation or in violation of the Nuremberg Code, which both U.S. and U.K. were the primary architects of?
Excellent points, all. So this, the reason the report is called the CHILCOT Report is that its primary author and the person who brought it together is a man named Sir John CHILCOT. And the report is immense. It's 12 volumes long, 2.2 million words. But during the day that it was released, John CHILCOT spoke to the press, and he presented five key findings that the report had come to. The first is that when the UK decided to join the invasion of Iraq, they did so before all the peaceful options for disarmament had been explored or exhausted. He says military action at that time was not a last resort. Now, those of you who remember the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003 will remember that we were being told by the Bush administration in the U.S. and the Blair administration in Britain that Saddam Hussein had refused to disarm, that he was dragging his feet, that it was impossible to expect that he would disarm, even though at the very same time, the NAEA, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, actually said that Saddam Hussein was cooperating, that there were some places where he was a little slower than they would have liked, but that they thought it was a matter of months, not years, before they had completed all of the disarmament work they were doing. So number one, that the invasion happened before it was necessary. I'll come back to that whole necessary question, because there's a real question about whether or not, even if Saddam Hussein had refused to disarm, whether the actual invasion was legal. But we'll come back to that. Secondly, that the judgments that the British and U.S. population were presented with about the danger that Iraq posed because of their weapons of mass destruction, those dangers were presented to the public as if they were absolutely certain, when in fact they were not particularly well known or well qualified, well justified, even within the Bush administration. And so, again, this threat that turned out to be completely baseless, because they never found the weapons of mass destruction, turns out to have been oversold. And, you know, the key example in this country of overselling it was a few weeks before the invasion, some of the top people in the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, the head of the armed forces, Richard Meyer, and Condoleezza Rice, all made the rounds of the Sunday morning talk shows, and they all used this same phrase about not wanting the smoking gun in Saddam Hussein's Iraq to turn out to be a mushroom cloud. Now, there was no possibility that there were nuclear weapons in Iraq, although there were some very strange efforts to make it look as though there might be. So that's finding number two, that they oversold this whole danger of these weapons of mass destruction. Number three, in spite of the fact that people knew and said, and experts on the region said, that the consequences of the invasion could be disastrous, they completely underestimated what those consequences would be. And so, for example, even though everyone knew that the Sunni and Shia segments of the population lived in tremendous tension, everyone knew that once the top was sliced off of the Iraqi government, that unless there were plans put in place, the country would descend into chaos. This was not a big surprise, because they were warned. The planning and the preparations for Iraq after Saddam Hussein, says Chilcott, were wholly inadequate. Then he says the government failed to achieve its stated objectives. And those objectives were the same thing that the Bush administration said: we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and in his place, we're going to establish a liberal U.S.-style democracy, and that will lead to greater stability in the entire region. As we've seen, that invasion has led to the exact opposite, greater instability. And then finally, number five, and this one is really important, that Blair and also Jack Straw, who was the equivalent of our Secretary of State, their foreign minister, blamed France and also Russia for an impasse at the UN, and said that the UK government was acting on behalf of the international community in an attempt to strengthen the authority of the Security Council by going against the Security Council's own rules and beginning an invasion of Iraq without a Security Council resolution. This is one of the key things that makes the invasion of Iraq illegal under the UN Charter, which the United States and Britain, of course, were not only signatories to, but the founding members of. They put the thing together. Now, this is important because, and I don't want to get too deeply in the weeds here, but there was a Security Council resolution called number 1441, which essentially said, Saddam Hussein, we're not happy with how quickly you're disarming, and we are going to put more sanctions on you, and we reserve the authority to do other bad things to you and your country if we're not happy. That one passed. But at the time, both France and Russia were which are two members of the five permanent members of the Security Council, were very reluctant to pass it. And so our State Department, our head of the State Department, Colin Powell, our ambassador to the UN, and the UK ambassador to the UN all went into those chambers and made the same statement, almost identical words. They said, before we would launch an invasion, we will absolutely come back to the Security Council for a resolution authorizing military action. They never did that. And in fact, if you read President Bush's memoir, there's a whole little, which is called Decision Points. There's a whole section in there about the terrible decision he had to make to invade Iraq once he realized that they weren't going to be able to get this resolution from the Security Council. And he finally decided, well, if we can't get, you know, the Security Council, I'll go to those two gigantic military powers, Spain and Portugal, and get their support. And so the coalition of the willing begins with Spain, Portugal, Great Britain, and, of course, the United States, and without the approval of the UN. A few months after the invasion, Kofi Annan, who was still at that time the Secretary General of the UN, actually said up front, the war in Iraq is illegal. So this is the final thing I want to say about the Chilcot Report, which is that there was one thing that they chose not to make any kind of decree about. And what they said is they have not decided, they have not issued an opinion about whether this military action was illegal. Chilcot said only a properly constituted international court can make that decision. And therefore, but what they have said is they think that the kind of review they did to decide whether it was legal or not was really inadequate, and that the legal basis clearly was far from satisfactory. So that sort of sums up what those 2.2 million words say. And, of course, no properly constituted court, an internationally recognized court, has yet begun to haul either the people, the principals from Britain or the Bush administration in front of any kind of tribunal, and it's really about time that they did.
I appreciate your opening statements. I'm going to ask you now to give a comment to what President Bush had to say in this brief analysis and justification of his after the event. And I would like for you to listen to his arguments and then show us how you would deconstruct them, all right?
Okay.
This is President Bush. We're having a technical glitch.
Technical issues.
Sorry, we'll get it working in just a moment. In the interim, there were those in the United States who were stating that we have a serious problem, because my program was on WPFW at Pacifica Station for 31 years, every week, every day of the week, in Monday through Friday in Washington, D.C. So I had a lot of people within that audience who listened. And at a lecture I did down there before the invasion, here is what he said. He said, Gary, they're choosing their own intelligence. They're manufacturing their intelligence out of Dick Cheney's office with Scooter Libby. They're then going to leak that to the New York Times, Judith Miller, who then will state that her source, which these guys came up with, who already had been discredited in intelligence circles, they already knew that he was a fraud, that she will state that she has this special source, and then after she does her story, then the New York Times will be quoted by Cheney's office saying, well, even the New York Times says this. So they were controlling this. So the idea that they had misinformation is a lie.
Oh,
they did not have misinformation. They created their own intelligence, including with the head of the CIA, and that, in any court of law, would be constituting the grounds for some form of legal action against them. We now, I believe, have a computer ready, and let's hear George Bush.
Okay.
Insiders, to kill innocent life, who would who had relations with Zarqawi. Imagine what the world would be like with him in power. The idea is to try to help change the Middle East. Now, look, part of the reason we went into Iraq was the main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq, and I also talked the need to advance a freedom agenda. And so my answer to your question is that imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein was there, stirring up even more trouble in a part of the world that had so much resentment and so much hatred that that people came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and, you know, kind of stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing. Except for it's part of, and nobody's ever suggested in this administration that Saddam Hussein ordered the attack. Iraq was a, the lesson of September 11th is take threats before they fully materialize, Ken. Nobody's ever suggested that the attacks of September the 11th were ordered by Iraq. I have suggested, however, that resentment and the lack of hope create the breeding grounds for terrorists who are willing to use suiciders to kill to achieve an objective. I have made that case. And one way to defeat that, defeat resentment, is with hope. And the best way to do hope is through a form of government. Now, I said going into...
Okay. So he's stating... listen to what he had to say. You just heard it. I'm going to add a few other points on that I would like you to address when you're deconstructing his argument, because his argument is the neocon argument. Very same people who were wrong about Vietnam, the same people who were wrong about Iraq and Afghanistan are the very same people still in power in the media or in the government who are wrong about Libya, wrong about Syria, wrong about the Sudan, and especially when it comes to Libya, because... I decided to do an in-depth analysis of Libya before the invasion and then after. And what I found before was that he had more freedom for women in Libya, Muslim women, than any other Muslim nation in the world, that they shared their oil wealth with people. When other oil was sold, it would go into everyone's account, something not done anywhere else. It was the number one economy in Africa. The highest level of education of any country in Africa. They had the best healthcare system in all of Africa. They had the best educational system in Africa. They had the largest man-made aquifer in the world, which was going to be helping hundreds of millions of African villages in many different countries to have water where they would not have had water otherwise, bringing water to arid areas. And that was bombed. And also, he was working against terrorists. There were no terrorists in this country, and yet he was holding together over 220 different tribes with different beliefs and different values, and it was called the Paris of Africa at that time, Libya was. Now, what you think of Saddam, what you think of Gaddafi personally is your business. But if you look at what Libya was then, and you look at Libya now, and you ask who participated, what was the outcome, and what lies were used to justify it, it's virtually the same as hearing Bush all over again. Your thoughts, please.
Okay. Well, you've laid out, you and Bush together have laid out a lot to counter. So let me, and I tend to agree with you to a large extent, although probably we're not exactly on the same page about Libya, but let's go back to Iraq. So first of all, Bush talks about Saddam Hussein as this terrible monster who attacks his own people, who kills innocent people. And, you know, people in this country have not the world's greatest historical memory. And so what a lot of people have forgotten that at the time when Saddam Hussein was actively involved in using chemical weapons against Kurds, the United States was actually Saddam Hussein's ally. We had joined or created what we called in those days the tilt towards Iraq in the war between Iraq and Iran that took place in the 1980s. And that was a terrible war. That was a war like a war of trench warfare like World War I in Europe. It was a war in which a generation of young men on both sides, but especially on the Iranian side, died in horrible ways in these trenches, and it was a war in which both sides used weapons that have been outlawed. But the United States kept that fight going by supporting Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was our friend right up until we decided that he wasn't, which is more or less the way that we have treated all the dictators that we have wanted to take credit for bringing down. They tend to have been our friends for, you know, up until about 10 minutes before we decided that, oops, they're our enemy after all. So I think I'm really glad you mentioned the neocons because, again, when Paul Wolfowitz came into Dick Cheney's office, he came along with Elliot Abrams and Richard Pearl and a number of people whose history goes back to Vietnam and Central America, as you said. And they came into the White House with a plan to take out Saddam Hussein. They had actually tried to sell this same plan to Israel in 1996 in a paper that they wrote for Israel called A Clean Break. And you've probably heard of this paper. It was signed by just about every neocon in the American pantheon of neocons. And what they were arguing to Benjamin Netanyahu at the time was that it would be wise for Israel to support the idea of, and here's what it says. They argued that Israel can shape its strategic environment in cooperation with Turkey and Jordan by weakening, containing, and even rolling back Syria. Such a campaign would begin by removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right, as a means of foiling Syria's regional ambitions. And the ultimate goal that they had in mind was a realignment of power in the Middle East, with Syria destabilized, a Hashemite king, and that's the same house that the kings of Jordan are from, a Hashemite king ruling Iraq, and a new regional alliance among Turkey, Jordan, and Israel. So, as it happened, Netanyahu said no thank you, I think because the clean break that was in the title of that was also a clean break from U.S. funding of Israel, and that was not something he was interested in. So then this same group of people set up an organization called a Project for a New American Century. And they presented a very similar proposal to President Bill Clinton in 1998. He also rejected it. But this same plan that starts with getting rid of Saddam Hussein goes on to destabilize Syria and continues to sow discord and really not stability but instability in the Middle East was the plan that Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz walked into the White House with. Let me say something about Bush's arguments about weapons of mass destruction. And he was saying, look, the problem, maybe it's true that he didn't actually have them, but he had the capacity to build them. So in sometime in the mid-2000s, Vanity Fair did an interview with Paul Wolfowitz, and they asked him about the weapons of mass destruction, and he said, here was the problem. There was disagreement between the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House about why we should go to war and what argument we should present to the public. And the only one that everyone could agree on was weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't the real reason, but it was the reason that everybody could agree would be something that you could sell to the American people, this idea that we were in imminent danger of weapons of mass destruction. In my book, American Nuremberg, I actually follow the lead of the original tribunals at Nuremberg, and as you may know, and some of your listeners may know, there was a big debate among the four great powers, so that's the Soviet Union, the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, at the time of the tribunals about the categories of crimes for which people were going to be tried. And ironically, because of their later actions, I say ironically, the U.S. and Britain argued that the chief crime, the first crime that people should be, that the high Nazi officials should be tried for, was the crime against peace, was making an illegal aggressive war. Because all the other crimes, all the deaths of between 65 and 80 million people, the crimes of the Holocaust, most of which did not take place in Germany, but in countries that Germany had invaded, all of those stemmed from that first crime of breaking the treaty, the 1928 Kellogg-Briand Treaty that all of these nations, including the U.S., had signed, a treaty which is still legally in force, which was a non-aggression pact. And the Nazis had broken that treaty. In a similar way, I think that the desire to make war against Iraq is really the fundamental crime of the Bush administration, and it led to many of the other crimes, including the torture. So torture began because early on, in late 2001 and very early 2002, the CIA was under pressure from Dick Cheney, and the people who had opened and were running the prison in Guantanamo were under pressure from Donald Rumsfeld to get somebody that they were detaining to make a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda had attacked the United States. And so the torture began. Abu Zubaydah, who was the first person that the United States waterboarded, he was waterboarded 83 times. And for people who think waterboarding is just a nice little sort of imitation drowning, no. What it is real drowning, and it's horrible. And if you read the Senate Intelligence Committee's report, their description of what Abu Zubaydah looked like after one of these sessions when he was unconscious, unresponsive, with bubbles rising through his open, unresponsive mouth that was full of water. This is what they did to this man. And what did they want from him? They wanted him to say there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. The only problem was he had nothing to do with al-Qaeda himself. But he eventually told them what they wanted to hear, and they used this for years as a justification. So when Bush says that nobody ever said Saddam Hussein ordered the attacks on the United States, that's true. But people in the Bush administration over and over again drew connections between the attacks of September 11th and Saddam Hussein. And they said, you know, Saddam Hussein was working with al-Qaeda. We have people who have testified, you know, under interrogation, have told us this. They were training him in making poison weapons. So, you know, President Bush is being more than a little disingenuous when he says, we never said Saddam Hussein ordered the attacks. But they certainly implied that he and al-Qaeda had been in cahoots. And in fact, that is a ridiculous claim because, as it happens, al-Qaeda hated Saddam Hussein. Al-Qaeda was not a supporter of Saddam Hussein because for most of his time as the president and dictator of Iraq, he actually presided over a secular country, a country that was brought together at the time of the Pan-Arabist movement and the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party, which it was his party, was also the party in power in Syria. And these people were not religious leaders. They were not theocrats. They believed in building a modern, developed, secular country, both in Syria and in Iraq. Now, those countries were not democracies, but they were secular countries until very late in the time that Saddam Hussein was in power. And so to suggest that al-Qaeda and Saddam were operating with similar objectives is simply not true. It's a lie. And it was a lie that the Bush administration told us. You know, I teach undergraduates, and it's very interesting to me. For every few years, I will ask my undergraduates, who attacked the United States on September 11th? What country did these people come from? And so early on, when I was teaching in 2004, 2005, and many of my students had people who were fighting in Iraq, or they had family members or boyfriends or girlfriends, they had people over there, and they were very concerned. I asked my students who attacked us on September 11th. They were all convinced it was Iraq. A few years later, when they were trying to gin up a war, since it worked out so well in Iraq, the next idea was, well, let's go attack Iran. And so when there was this attempt to get people in the United States excited about the idea of attacking Iran, once again, I asked my students, you know, who attacked us on September 11th? They were convinced that they were from Iran. Nobody ever said, oh, weren't 15 out of the 19 from Saudi Arabia, our great friend, our ally? Nobody ever said that, because the Bush administration had done such a good job of convincing us of using September 11th as an empty slate on which you could write the name of any enemy you wanted. I'm almost surprised that nobody told us that Muammar Gaddafi was behind September 11th.
I want to go a little further with your thoughts here, because if today you were able to be in a prosecutorial position with an international tribunal, and you had a chance to have Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Colin Powell on trial, what would be the most heinous offenses that this administration committed that you could show were in violation of Nuremberg?
Well, I would actually say that, and this is sort of surprising because, you know, I've written a whole book about torture, and I think torture is horrific and very bad for the moral character of the people who do it and the country that allows it. But in fact, in terms of the absolute cause of human misery, it's the illegal invasion of Iraq, because the consequences of that, first of all, the destruction of another industrialized, developed country with universities, with publishing houses, with, you know, all kinds of intellectual life, completely destroyed, first by 10 years of a sanction regime, and then followed by the destruction of the infrastructure of the country, and then the decapitation and destruction of all the governance possibility in that country, led to creating a refugee population of Iraqis somewhere between 3 and 5 million people. There are still 1.5 million internal refugees in Iraq today, 13 years after the invasion, not to mention the people who ended up in Syria and Jordan. And I actually had a chance in 2006 to go to those countries and to interview people who were refugees from the Iraq War. But in addition to that, there are the millions or the hundreds of thousands who have died. And it's very hard to get an accurate count. And many different people have done different counts of the number of people who died simply as a result of the invasion and then the occupation. But different counts have put it anywhere between 150,000 and 650,000 excess deaths, violent deaths, that are a result of the direct result of the invasion by the United States and to a lesser extent Britain and other countries. So that's number one. Then the fact that that destabilization, that destruction of Iraq, was part of a larger plan which included destabilizing Syria. And when we look at what has happened in Syria today, and I'm not going to deny that the Syrian people have their own agency, and I'm not going to deny that Syria under Bashar Assad is a police state, no question about it. I've been there, it is. But nonetheless, that the way that conflict has taken off has created the greatest refugee crisis that Europe has seen since the end of World War II. Over half the population, the entire population of Syria, has been made a refugee, either inside the country or outside the country. There are something like 5 million Syrians who are still desperately trying to get from wherever they've landed, whether it's Turkey or Northern Africa, desperately attempting to get into Europe, where they are being refused the asylum that they absolutely are legally due. So number one, I would say it's that crime against peace. Number two, there are war crimes. War crimes are violations of the laws and conventions of customs of war. And you can really only have war crimes when you have an actual war. And this gets to another problem that we have with this so-called war on terror, which is that it isn't really, except in Iraq and Afghanistan and now Syria, a war, in the sense that there are armies regularly confronting each other in a sustained way. In fact, many of the places where the United States has been involved in this so-called war on terror, it's not a war at all. And that throws, you know, in a legal sense, that throws the terrible things we're doing into a different category. But actual war crimes have existed. For example, the United States has bombed, most recently in Kunduz in Afghanistan, brought airstrikes in and destroyed a hospital belonging to Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, even though they were on the phone at the time to the Americans saying, please stop bombing our hospital, and yet they destroyed it. Now, we have since seen an investigation and a bunch of people who at the lower level have been knocked down and lost their commissions, but the reality is that's a war crime. Another one that doesn't get talked about much is what happened in Fallujah. In Fallujah, the United States used weapons that, going all the way back to just war theory from the Middle Ages, are considered to be violations of a just war. And that's using weapons that are evil in and of themselves. The Latin is mala in se, evil in itself. And in the case of Fallujah, ironically, a country, you know, in Iraq where we had invaded a country because we thought they had chemical weapons, the United States used white phosphorus. And initially they said, and for people who don't know, phosphorus is one of the elements in the periodic table, and one of the things that's interesting about it is that as soon as it is exposed to oxygen, it burns, and it burns very hot. And if white phosphorus falls out of the sky and happens to land on your body, it will burn through your skin and your fat and your flesh all the way to your bone. Initially, when it was reported in the Italian press that the United States had used white phosphorus in Fallujah, they said, oh, no, we didn't do that. And then they said, oh, well, yes, we did, but it was only for illumination. We needed to be able to see what we were bombing, so we used white phosphorus. Then finally, it became really clear that they had used it as an anti-personnel weapon, as a form of attack that would leave terrible, terrible wounds, both in soldiers and also in any civilians who happened to be in the way. And that gets into the larger question of civilian deaths, and there have been many, as there are in any war. You know, for just to make a quick reference to the Second World War, as I said before, somewhere between 65 and 80 million people, which is an literally unimaginable number, died in that war. The majority, by far, were civilians. And this is true of all our modern wars. Okay, then finally, there are questions of human rights crimes. The torture, if it took place in Iraq or if it took place in Afghanistan and it happened to people who were detained on the battlefield in those countries, those are violations of the Geneva Conventions. Even if those people were what the Bush administration decided to call illegal combatants, which is not a category that the Geneva Conventions even recognize, there is no such thing, unlawful combatants, even if they were unlawful combatants, they still were protected by the Geneva Conventions, just a different part of those conventions, which protect civilians, and which say you may not mistreat those people, you may not subject them to torture or cruel or degrading treatment. And so those are the torture of people in those war theaters is absolutely a war crime. But the people who have been arrested, who have been kidnapped around the world in places as far-flung as Macedonia, Pakistan, Yemen, other places, picked up on the street, and Italy is another, and either sent to a third country to be tortured or taken to one of the CIA black sites and tortured. Those are not exactly war crimes. And part of the problem we have, that part of the legacy of Nuremberg, in a way, is that we sort of think that a war crime is more serious than a human rights crime. But murder is murder. Torture is torture. It just happens to fall under a different piece of international law. But they are still illegal, and they are still crimes. So those are the three categories: the crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against human rights. And in my book, I actually detail all of these and talk about who needs to be held responsible. And I would add that one set of crimes has we've gotten used to because it's kind of a Trojan horse. And I'm talking about the use of unpiloted aircraft, what we call drones. Then they're not unpiloted. They're remotely piloted. They're piloted by people sitting in air-conditioned shipping containers way out in the Nevada desert, and they're killing people half a world away as if they were playing Call of Duty on their video screens. But we've gotten so fascinated by this technology that we think the point is that we're using drones for this. But the real point is that what this is an assassination program. If the United States were sending death squads all over the world to do the same thing on the ground that we're doing from the air, it wouldn't have that technological sizzle, and it wouldn't look, it would look like what it really is, which is murder. These are extra-legal murders. They are executions which the U.S. says it has the right to perform because the people that we are attacking represent an imminent danger to the United States. And the Justice Department actually issued a memo for the Obama administration to support continuing this this drone assassination program. And in that memo, what they said is, basically, that word imminent, it doesn't really mean immediate or about to happen. But in fact, if anybody is a leader in any way of any of the myriad organizations we have decided are part of the enemy in this war on terror, then by definition, they are always and continually planning attacks against the United States, and therefore, by definition, they represent an imminent danger, and we have the right to murder them no matter whose country they're in, no matter where they are, even if they happen to be U.S. citizens, as in the case of Anwar al-Maliki. So that's another example of a kind of crime that has actually been carried forward, started with the Bush administration in Yemen in 2003, and has increased ninefold under the Obama administration, sadly.
That's important for us to understand this, because when you talk about the horror that occurs to civilians who hear a drone, and now
exactly.
The children even look at the skies and they're suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's right.
And now we have also an enormous amount of evidence that the American media has never once, not 60 Minutes, not Dateline, and that is what was given during the filming of a Gulf War syndrome, killing our own.
Mm-hmm.
A group of physicians in Fallujah at a hospital said, here are 5,000 photographs. Please get this to the American people. These are our babies being born with cyclops
yep.
eyes, with eye in the middle of the head,
yep.
skulls
yep.
with no brains.
Yep.
And the doctor said, we've never seen these deformities in
mm-hmm.
our country's history. This is due to
depleted uranium.
Depleted uranium. And as a result, we're telling people don't have babies because of depleted uranium. Your Defense Department refuses to acknowledge this. So every
yep.
bomb, every bullet, it vaporizes. And once it vaporizes into millions of particulate matter, it stays
mm-hmm.
in the air. This is the desert.
Mm-hmm.
It's no place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that's another crime against humanity that has not been
absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely.
Now, before
and
we
another
go,
illegal arm, I would say, another
yeah.
illegal form of armament.
Now, what I want to do is this. in this important Chilcot, in these 2 million words that he wrote, what is not stated was how much opposition there was within Blair's own parliament, and yet none of those people, not one of those people's words were given any credibility, and yet these were distinguished statespersons who had looked at the evidence. I want you to hear what one of them had to say. Now, this is what they had to say about what went really badly wrong, and yet no one is paying attention to how right this man and others like him were compared to the charisma of a Tony Blair who just swiped these people to the side. Let's listen in now.
Against Saddam Hussein, claiming the Iraqi leader had stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, although none were ever found. The inquiry into Britain's participation in Iraq, led by retired civil servant John Chilcot, took 7 years to publish. It stretches to 2.6 million words. Its conclusions are damning.
The UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
In one declassified memo, Prime Minister Blair told his American counterpart that he would be with him whatever, 8 months before the invasion. In a response lasting 2 hours Wednesday, Mr. Blair insisted there was no rush to war.
Back then, barely more than a year from 9/11, in late 2002 and early 2003, you're seeing the intelligence mount up on WMD. You're doing so in a changed context of mass casualties caused by a new and virulent form of terrorism.
The former Prime Minister apologised to the families of British servicemen and women who had lost their lives and for the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed during the war and its aftermath. But he refused to say he had made the wrong decision.
What changed was not anything in Iraq, it was 9/11 and Afghanistan. And that what's led to the American push for an invasion of Iraq, but actually the report argues containment, the sanctions that were in place to stop Saddam getting weapons of mass destruction, were not perfect, but they were working and they could have been given more time.
Outside, relatives of soldiers killed in Iraq listened to the evidence.
The healing that I thought I started to find, that peace I started to find after 11 and a half years, I've gone back to that moment when I first heard those words, that Bob O'Connor's missing in action, presumed dead.
And the suffering continues in Iraq. Several hundred thousand have been killed in sectarian violence since the US-led invasion. One of the deadliest attacks came just this week when suicide bombers killed 250 people in Baghdad. The Chilcot inquiry may mark the closing of a dark chapter in British politics. In Iraq, the brutal consequences are still being written. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
All right, that was how it was handled in England.
I
want you to respond to the fact that today we seem to have forgotten the debate that was occurring at the time and the sheer power of a Tony Blair, his charisma at the time, his popularity at the time, and just swiping aside everyone who challenged him.
Absolutely right. And in this country, I mean, we can hardly say that either Dick Cheney or George W. Bush had much in the way of charisma. But I have to say that what did happen, and not only in this country and in England, but really all over the world, was that apart from what happened in Congress and in public debate, out on the streets, millions of people, 12 million people around the world, were out on the streets saying, do not do this, do not start this war. And it included not only the people, but even many governments said to the United States and to Britain, do not do this. It was so big that in The Nation, Jonathan Schell, the distinguished journalist, wrote a cover story for The Nation that was called The New Superpower. And he was talking about the power of ordinary people out in the streets to demand that this war not begin. And so what's interesting is that although if you followed the mainstream press and you paid attention to Tony Blair and to the spokespeople for the Bush administration, you got the sense that apart from a few brave people in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, almost everybody was going along with it. But if you just turned your eyes away from the Capitol and looked at the streets of Washington, D.C., or New York, or San Francisco, or Paris, or London, or countries all over the world, you saw something else, which is that the people knew this was a really bad and illegal idea. And so it's, you know, it's more than terrible that these governments were able to completely bamboozle the representatives, you know, the parliament and the Congress. And it's also interesting to me to think of Blair as having all this charisma, because at the same time, or very shortly after, you began to see in the opposition press in England people referring to Blair as George Bush's poodle, his lapdog. And that became a little sobriquet that actually stuck to Blair for a while, Bush's poodle. So, yeah, I think, you know, I think in the United States, the problem, the reason that they were able to do this was September 11th. They came into the Bush White House with a plan. Before September 11th even, back, and people don't remember this, but back before the attacks in March and April of 2001, the biggest political issue at the time that especially people in the progressive world were talking about was the fact that Dick Cheney was in charge of preparing a new national energy strategy. And he was meeting in the White House. He was holding 50, 60 private meetings. He refused to say who the guest list were, literally the people he was meeting with to supposedly put together the new national energy strategy for the United States. Well, of course, he had just come from Halliburton, which is the world's largest company that services oil fields and oil companies, where he had gotten a $34 million golden parachute. And he had just left Halliburton, come to the White House, and the people he was meeting with were the top oil executives of U.S. oil companies. They even went up on Capitol Hill and testified before Congress and lied and said, oh, no, we haven't met with Dick Cheney. But they had. And what they were discussing was the invasion of Iraq, I beg your pardon, and how that would make the oil fields of Iraq available to U.S. and to a lesser extent to British oil companies. As it turned out, in the end, they didn't even get that objective met because most of the contracts didn't even go to U.S. oil companies. But that was the plan, and it had nothing to do with September 11th, but it was those terrible attacks that allowed the Bush administration, in spite of what they're saying now, to sell the war to the people in this country.
I'm interested in hearing what this is a short 2-minute clip that we're going to play to X out the program. This is one very articulate voice who was speaking out at the time against what Tony Blair and others were wanting to do. And hopefully at some future point where if and when there should be a tribunal, this person's full 12 minutes speech is given, is aired to the people in that court, but we only have time for 2 minutes. Let's listen to this from a member of parliament that no one in the American media paid attention to.
I finish just by saying this. War is an easy thing to talk about. There are not many people of the generation that remember it. The Right Honourable Gentleman served with distinction. The last war, I never killed anyone, but I wore uniform. But I was in London in the Blitz in 1940, living in the Millbank Tower where I was born. Some different ideas have come in since. And every night I went down to the shelter in Thames House. Every morning I saw Dockland burning. 500 people were killed in Westminster one night by a landmine. It was terrifying. Aren't Arabs terrified? Aren't Iraqis terrified? Don't Arab and Iraqi women weep when their children die? Doesn't bombing strengthen their determination? What fools we are to live in of a generation for which war is a computer game for our children and just an interesting little Channel 4 news item. Every Member of Parliament tonight who votes for the government motion will be consciously and deliberately accepting the responsibility for the deaths of innocent people if the war begins, as I fear it will. Now, that's for their decision to take. But this is a quite unique debate in my parliamentary experience where we're asked to share responsibility for a decision we won't really be taking with consequences for people who have no part to play in the brutality of the regime which we are dealing with. And I finish with this. On October the 24th, 1945, and the former Prime Minister from Bexley and Old Sutcliffe will remember it, the United Nations Charter was passed. And the words of that charter etched into my mind and move me even as I think of them. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save future generations, succeeding generations, from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge of that generation to this generation, and it would be the greatest betrayal of all if we voted to abandon the Charter and take unilateral action and pretend we were doing it in the name of the international community. And I shall vote against the motion for the reasons that I've given the House.
One person making a statement. He was right, everyone else was wrong. And the American media, the entire American media, chose to only listen to those who were wrong. And today, they're the very first ones to get in line to promote Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and any other neocon who wants to continue this misadventure. Professor Rebecca Gordon, thank you very much for the work you've done, especially the new book, which I believe a lot of people are now going to pay attention to because it's showing us what we could hold our leaders responsible for. America Nuremberg, the officials who should stand trial for post-9/11 war crimes. The website is mainstreamingtorture.org. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.
I'm your pusher man.